shoulder to shoulder, but not knowing what to say to each other. After 100 yards of misery, she broke into a sprint and charged ahead until she was lost from view among the other girls of the fourth. The rector was a frail old lamb with an enormous mop of white hair, who peered down at us from his pulpit like a lookout in the crow's nest of a ship in a stormy sea. Each of us, he was insisting, was no more than a section of scaffolding being used to help erect the greater glory of God. I could well picture him swaying slowly from side to side in his lofty perch as a bit of scaffolding, but as for me, no thank you. The very idea made me balk at the proceedings, so much so that when he finally gave the benediction and came creeping down to rejoin us other skeletons of steel, and the hymn was sung, I made a great point of setting myself apart from the proceedings by singing, "Praise my soul, the King of Heaven." Not that anyone noticed. They never do. Except Feely, of course. From her perch on the organ bench at St. Tancred's, my older sister was always able to hear even the slightest improvisation on my part, and would swing round her burning glass gaze to put me in my place. I was struck by a sudden pang. Dear God, I thought, how I miss her. As if she were here, I fell back into line with the other singers. Angels help us to adore him. Ye behold him face to face. Sun and moon bow down before him. Dwellers all in time and space. That was just it, wasn't it? That's what we were. Dwellers all in time and space. Not old scraps of iron lashed together like a meccano set by some invisible builder. Not on your bloody life. I looked over at Mrs. Bannerman. What did she think, I wondered, of being labelled a section of scaffolding? She had come within an ace of meeting her end on the most dreaded bit of scaffolding in the whole wide world. A date with the public hangman, I expect, is not one that can be easily forgotten. And yet, here she was, head held high, caroling away, bright-eyed, and with a slight mystical smile on her lips, as if science were her saviour. As if she knew something that none of the rest of us knew. Perhaps she did. Perhaps. In that instant, I understood what I must do. Of course I did. I had planned it all along. There is a standing and unwritten order in most churches that a worshipper taken ill is not to be interfered with. One minute it's, "We have left undone those things which we ought to have done, and we have done those things which we ought not to have done, and there is no health in us." And the next it's, "Action stations," as we flee hand over mouth to the nearest exit. It is a good rule, and one that I had taken advantage of in the past. Even before the last notes of the organ had died up among the rafters, I gave Mrs. Bannerman a tight, gulping smile. "Excuse me," I managed, edging my way to the end of the pew, and then I fled. The entire academy was here at church, and would be for at least the next hour. I turned my face towards the east and ran like a scalded rabbit. I needed to question Collingwood without interference, and this was the time to do it. After the purging I had given her, and a good night's sleep, she should have recovered sufficiently from the chloral hydrate to be subjected to a jolly good grilling. As I knew it would be, Miss Bodycote's was in perfect silence. There is always something vaguely unsettling about being alone in an empty building that is not your own. It is as if, whenever present inhabitants are away, the phantoms of former owners come shimmering out of the woodwork to protect their territory. Although you cannot see these ghosts, you can certainly feel their unwelcoming presence, and sometimes even smell them, a sort of shivering in the air that tells you that you're not alone and not wanted. Like layers of ancient paint, the older ones underlie the newer, fainter, paler perhaps, and yet, for all that, far more ominous. What sights have been witnessed by these arching ceilings, I wondered. What tragedies have played out in these ancient halls? My back sprouted goosebumps. Up the cold dim stairs I flew and into the infirmary, as if all the demons of hell were gnashing their teeth at my heels. The gaunt drapes were drawn round Collingwood's bed. "Quickly," I said in a hoarse whisper. "Get up. Get dressed. We're getting you out of here." The curtain rings shrieked on their metal rods as I yanked back the hanging curtain. Collingwood's bed was not only empty, it was as neatly and as freshly made as if it had been arranged for a magazine photograph. "Well, well," said a voice behind me, and I spun round. Ryerson Rainsmith was closing the clasps of a black leather doctor's bag. "Of course. Flavia, you idiot!" Dr. Rainsmith, his wife had called him on the ship, and I had not heard because I had not wanted to hear. It was Rainsmith who had been dosing Collingwood with chloral hydrate, and it was Rainsmith whom Fitzgibbon had been referring to when she said she'd have the doctor look in later. How could I have been such a fool not to see it? "Where's Collingwood?" I demanded. "What have you done with her?"
"Confidentiality between doctor and patient forbids me from answering," Ryerson Rainsmith said quietly. "Besides, I'm in charge here. This is my infirmary. It is I who should be asking the questions."
"He's right, you know," said another voice behind me, and I spun round. Dorsey Rainsmith had come up silently behind me. I might have known. Her dress was a sand-coloured tent, its billows held in by a broad belt. Who knew what weapons were concealed beneath? There seemed room enough in it for racks of axes. "You have no business being here," she said. "Why aren't you in church with the others?"
"Where's Collingwood?" I asked again. "What have you done with her?"
"She's had a very bad shock," Rainsmith said. "She requires peace and quiet if she's to make a full recovery." I was not going to be shaken off so easily.
"Where is she? What have you done with her?"
"Dorsey," he said, giving his wife a brisk nod. I did not wait to be seized and clapped into a straitjacket. I did what any intelligent girl would do in the circumstances. I took to my heels. I clattered out of the room and down the stairs with the sound of falling tiles.
"Stop her, Ryerson," Dorsey shouted, but it was no use. I was younger, faster, and had a head start. At the bottom, I looked up and caught a glimpse of their white faces, like twin moons, staring down at me from above. I shot them an insolent grin, like the runaway pancake in the fairy tale, swiveled on my heel, and ran straight into the chest of Inspector Gravenhurst. I nearly knocked him over. The inspector looked even more surprised to see me than I was to see him. How long had he been standing there? How much had he seen and heard? It seemed obvious, at least to me, that he had come to Miss Bodycote's for a quiet Sunday morning snoop. After all, the doors were always left unlocked from dawn to dusk. And besides, who in their right mind would want to enter such a forbidding-looking fortress? The question was this: which of us was more embarrassed? I was faced with a sudden choice, and left with only an instant to make up my mind. Should I blow the whistle on the Rainsmiths for what they had done to Collingwood, or should I keep my trap shut and take my chances on gaining the upper hand? Well, if you know Flavia Deluce as well as I do, you'll know that it's a mug's question.
Oh, Inspector, I said,
and I'm ashamed to admit that I allowed my eyelids and eyelashes to flutter almost imperceptibly.
I was hoping to see you again. Have you had any luck identifying the body in the chimney?
Oh, Flavia, you puncturer of other people's importance. What a saucy thing to say to the poor man.
Luck? As if the Toronto police were only capable of solving crimes by a toss of the dice, or by pulling lots from some plump constable's hat.
As a matter of fact, we have, Mr. Luce, he said. It was front page news in all the papers, but I don't suppose you see them at Miss Bodycote's, do you?
So, Wallace Scroope must have got his story after all. Not knowing what to say, I glanced up at the two faces that were still staring blankly down from the landing, like a masked chorus waiting to make their entrance. The inspector, following my gaze, spotted the Rainsmiths.
"Ah, Dr. Rainsmith," he said. "Good morning. Perhaps, as the pathologist of record, you're in a much better position than I am to answer this young lady's question."
Pathologist? Ryerson Rainsmith, the pathologist? Besides being the Academy's appointed medical doctor and chairman of the Board of Guardians? How improbably bizarre. How downright dangerous.
But it was not Ryerson Rainsmith who responded to the inspector's words. In fact, quite the contrary. It was Dorsey Rainsmith, his wife, who began her slow descent of the stairs toward me.
"I shall be happy to, Inspector," she said.
"You may leave it to me."
Chapter 21. I suppose I should have screamed, but I didn't. Instead, as if in a trance, I watched as the inspector, with no more than a quick nod, vanished out the door. Caught red-handed in an unauthorized Sunday invasion of the empty premises, he couldn't get away quickly enough, which left me alone with the Rainsmiths. I didn't have many options. Since recent circumstances had resulted in my becoming a backslider in the fingernail-biting department, I had nothing to count upon for self-defense but my fists and my feet. How I wished I had taken the time to pump Dogger for more details about the Kano system of jiu-jitsu, which he once admitted he had studied for a time. One or two of the deadly blows would have come in handy just about now. A quick chop here and a clever thrust there, and it would be nighty-night to the abominable Rainsmiths. But the sad truth is that I was so poleaxed at the thought of Dorsey Rainsmith.
Dorsey Rainsmith, being not only a doctor, but also the pathologist, who had examined the body in the chimney, that my brain went into the kind of deep freeze that must have been experienced at the end by Captain Scott of the Antarctic.
Huh? Was all I could manage. Meanwhile, Dorsey was oozing down the staircase with slow, cautious steps, the way you might approach a rattlesnake that has been run over by a car and is writhing, injured, at the side of the road. I had the most awful feeling that she was suddenly going to produce a blanket from somewhere about her abominable person and throw it over my head. Her mouth was moving meaninglessly, but no sound was emerging. And then I realized that she had been talking to me, but I hadn't been listening.
"A very bad shock," she was saying.
"Shock? Who was she talking about? Collingwood or me?
Were they planning to bind me in wet bedsheets and pump me full of chloral hydrate?
Was there a chimney waiting for Flavia de Luce?
It was only at that moment, I think, that my mind finally grasped how horribly far from home I was, and how off balance and deprived of sleep. In ordinary circumstances, I would have dealt the Rainsmiths their comeuppance and be already dusting off my hands. But I was not. I was fighting for my life, and I knew it. I backed slowly away from the descending Dorsey, matching her step for step in a deadly tango, edging ever closer to the door.
"Wait," she said. "You don't understand."
"Oh, yes, I do, Miss Knockout Drops. I understand all too perfectly." The average person, I suppose, does not often stop to think about what can be done to one's body by a pair of homicidal medical doctors. The very thought of it is enough to make the blood dry up like the Dead Sea. They could, for instance, remove my organs, slowly and one at a time, until nothing was left on the dissecting table but my two eyeballs rolling wildly about in search of mercy, and my arms and legs. Or they could... But enough. I knew that I would have one chance, and one chance only, to get myself out of this scrape. Should I run, attack, or use my brain? The decision was an easy one.
"Daddy!" I called out with a glance toward one of the empty hallways. "Look who's here! It's Mr. and Mrs. Rainsmith!"
In real life, if I had ever stooped to calling Father Daddy, we both of us should have shriveled up and died from mortification. But this was not real life. It was a bit of impromptu theatre I was staging to save my bacon. And with that vile name, Daddy, on my lips, I slowly strolled casually off with open arms toward my invisible parent, who was standing, so to speak, in the wings.
"I hope your flight wasn't too tiresome," I said loudly, once I was out of their sight. And it worked.
The Rainsmiths, as far as I knew, had remained frozen on the staircase, hadn't moved a muscle, in fact, until sometime after I had crept quietly out the back door and made my way round to the laundry. The key I had pinched made it a matter of less than 3 seconds, I counted, before I was inside that hellish temple of cleanliness, a phrase I borrowed from Daffy, who always used it to describe Armfields, the only London dry cleaners to whom Father would entrust his threadbare wardrobe, except his linens, of course, which were permitted to be washed, ironed, stiffened with potato starch, and correctly folded by no one but Mrs. Mullet in the kitchen of her cottage in Cobbler's Lane. Again, a pang of something struck at my heart. I swallowed and looked round the cavernous laundry. "Lock the door," my brain commanded, and I obeyed instantly. Because it was Sunday, the place was cold and clammy, and, with the machines shut off, the great boilers as quiet as a pair of landlocked submarines, the whole place was as silent as the grave. I shivered. Never in my life had I felt more of a trespasser, and that was saying a lot. For a minute or two, I stood motionless on the same spot, listening. But there was not a sound. Surely, even if the Rainsmiths had the nerve to follow me, I would hear their footsteps. The gravel outside the door would guarantee it. Meanwhile, I might as well make use of the fact that I was now locked into the laundry, and probably would be for some time. What better excuse for a jolly good snoop? On my first visit to this hell hole, I had glimpsed briefly, through the steam, a small room in one corner, no more than a cubicle, really, which appeared to be an office. Might as well start there. A battered wooden desk with an ancient telephone handset and a mechanical chair with protruding springs took up most of the space. On the back wall were shelves lined with ledgers, bound in linen. Most of them dated on their spines with a span of years. 1943 to 46, 1931 to 35, and so forth. I pulled open the desk drawers one by one. Of the six, two were empty, and the remaining four contained a remarkably uninteresting lot of litter. Rubber stamps, ink in a pad, the mouldy remains of a cheese sandwich in waxed paper, a bottle of Jergens lotion, aspirin, a pair of rubber gloves, a rubber finger protector, pencils, broken, red and black, and two dog-eared paperbacks, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, and How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. Ditto. Not very encouraging. But in the bottom right-hand drawer was a fat telephone directory, its curled cover jamming the sliding rail. I could not seem to free it, and could not look behind it without getting down onto my hands and knees on the unsanitary stone floor. By bending my elbow at a scarecrow angle, I was somehow able to work my hand behind the bowed book. My fingers came in contact with something furry. My first thought was that it was a dead mouse, one that had nibbled on the cheese sandwich, perhaps, and expired of penicillin poisoning or anaphylaxis. I fought down my girlish instinct to pull my hand away, or perhaps even to scream. I forced my fingers to close around the object and pull it into view. It was a sock, a red wool sock, and I knew at once that I had seen its mate before. I studied it carefully and shoved it back into the drawer. Fingerprints, I knew, could not be retrieved from most fabrics, least of all wool. But I had seen all that I needed to see, and I wouldn't want to be accused of tampering excessively with evidence. Besides, there was no point in taking it with me for comparison when its matching mate was in the morgue. Turning my attention to the shelf of ledgers, I took down the rightmost book, 1950, its ending date not yet lettered, obviously the current volume. The binding gave a dusty sigh and a brisk crackle as I opened the book, and the smell of sweat and old starch came to my nostrils. These were the laundry registers of Miss Bodycote's Female Academy. Would they be of any use in my investigations? I remembered something Mrs. Mallet had once told me when I had made a condescending joke about her galvanized tubs. "Don't ever look down your nose at your laundry maid, miss," she had snapped in a rare show of short temper. "We knows what you eats, what you drinks, and what you gets up to in between. There's many a tale told on the scrub board." I hadn't known what she meant, but it sounded like a handy bit of knowledge to keep up my sleeve for future reference. And now, it seemed, was the time. I leafed through the pages of the ledger, each one ruled into five columns: date, name, item, notes, and charge. For instance, September 10th, 1951. Scarlet A. SWWL 2. BLM 2. ST 2. TUN. HNK 2. NGTN. $1.85. From which I deduced that Amelia Scarlett's parents were to be charged $1.85 for the laundering of two woolen sweaters, two pairs of bloomers, a form of undergarment I thought existed nowadays only in rude poems and even ruder songs, two pairs of stockings, a tunic, two handkerchiefs, and a nightgown. This was a recent entry made not much more than a month ago. What tales would be told by the entries from a couple of years ago, in the aftermath, for instance, of the Beaux Arts Ball? Surely such an extravagant event would never pass without a few spilled glasses of punch or lemonade. I reached for the previous volume. Inside the front cover were pasted calendars for 1947, 1948, and 1949, with various dates ticked off in ink. Yes, here we were in June 1949, which had four Saturdays, the 4th, 11th, 18th, and 25th. The Beaux Arts Ball must have taken place on one of them. The question was, which? There were a flurry of entries before and after the 18th, people having their clothing cleaned before the ball and mopping up afterward, or so I guessed. I could check the actual date later with someone who knew. I leafed on through the book, more out of idle curiosity than anything. Mrs. Mullet was right. The laundry staff knew everything. Here, in remarkable detail, were the rips and the tears, the spills and the stains of everyday life. Doxon, M., for instance, had spilled hydrochloric acid on her blouse in chemistry class. Johnson, S., had ripped her tunic on barbed wire during a hare and hounds chase, while some clown named Terwilliger, A., had fallen downstairs with two jam tarts in her pocket. It was all recorded in horrible, laughable, fascinating detail. As my eyes swept across the 6th of July, a familiar name caught my eye. Brazenose, C. Clarissa Brazenose. But wait, hadn't she vanished weeks earlier? The night of the Beaux Arts Ball, and reappeared 2 years later, at least according to Scarlett, the night before our trip to the training camp. The same day, coincidentally, as my walk in the churchyard with Miss Fawthorne, and on the eve of my first class in the chemistry lab with Mrs. Bannerman. Could there be a connection? Where had she been for the past 600-and-some-odd days? For that matter, where was she now? Assuming that Clarissa Brazenose was still alive and not a spectre, it could hardly have been her body that had tumbled down the chimney. Whose was it, then? My mind was writhing with ideas like so many snakes in a pit. For instance, I had not so far come across any entries for the teaching staff. Perhaps they were expected to see to their own laundry expenses. But was that likely? Any institution with such a great roaring steam laundry as Miss Bodycote's would surely not deny its services to the faculty. Another reach to the top shelf brought down an unmarked volume. Aha! This was more like it. Fawthorne, Puddicombe, Moat, Bannerman, Fitzgibbon. Here they were, the faculty bigwigs, in all their laundered glory. I was exalted for about 6.5 seconds, and then I saw that there were no informative details given, as there had been for the students. The items cleaned were simply listed, which made sense, of course, since the owners were not being charged for the service. But what had I expected? Cyanide stains on the frock of Mrs. Bannerman, close to the date of her husband's demise? It was too much to hope. Life didn't work that way. Nor did death. The only item of interest was a recurring entry for overalls under the name Kelly. At last! Here was my missing K, that so far invisible person who stoked the boilers, or whatever it was he or she did, to require access to the laundry, whose key I had just used to gain entry to the place. I saw at once that Kelly was subject to rips and grass stains, and once each to tar and lock oil. I was standing there with the book in my hand, when from the corner of my eye I caught a sudden movement. I whipped round and found myself face to face with a cliff of hulking flesh. Where on earth had he come from? I had locked the door behind me when I came in, and the only other access to the laundry was by way of a pair of steel doors at the back, which, as I could plainly see, were locked and barred. He must have been here all along. The very thought of it made my toes curl.
"What are you up to?" he demanded
in a wood-rasp voice. The smell of alcohol almost bowled me over. It didn't take the brains of a Sherlock Holmes to deduce that this bruiser had been drinking behind the boilers. His red encrusted eyes told the rest of the tale. Here was a man who made the most of a quiet Sunday to have a nip and a nap. There were probably hundreds like him the world over. "I found the door unlocked," I said, with just a trace of recrimination in my voice, a trick I had learned from Feely. I waved the laundry book at him. "I was just looking to see if Miss Falthorne's number is listed. I intended to ring her up and then stand guard until she can come and secure the place. What I mean is that I've just rung her up, and I'm waiting for her to arrive." The fact that it was Sunday, and that Miss Falthorne and her entire scurvy crew and officers were away at church, hardly mattered to this boozy specimen, or at least I hoped it didn't. "Alcohol is impervious to logic," my late Uncle Tarquin had written in one of his laboratory notebooks. Though whether this insight was from personal experience, a specific chemical observation, or simply a bit of stray philosophy, I had never been able to decide.
"No, don't do that," the man snarled, wrenching the book from my hands. "I'm in charge here. If the doors is open..."
He fumbled as if he couldn't think of the next word.
"It's because I opened it, see?"
His vaporous breath trembled in the air, making the laundry seem more than ever like Dante's Inferno. I found myself waiting for lava to come bubbling from his mouth. "Here you are, Flavia, locked in a soundproof stone building with an angry, inebriated stranger who's three times your size and weight. A bruiser who, with one fist, could reduce you to a splatter of jam on the floorboards. There's no one nearby to rescue you. You're on your own. It's brains against brawn."
"You must be Mr. Kelly," I said, sticking out a hand.
The human mountain struggled to focus, edging his feet farther apart for better balance, his stale eyes staring.
"Miss Falthorne has often spoken so well of you," I added, "that I feel as if we've already met."
And then, incredibly, a great oily ham of a hand came forward and seized mine.
"How do you do, miss? Edward Kelly is my name."
A wave of something swept over me, and I had a sudden vision of this pathetic human being as a boy, standing defenseless before some schoolmaster or schoolmistress, now long dead.
"Say, how do you do, Edward?"
He shuffled his feet, then and now, and I knew for a fact that those words had never, ever, since that long-ago day, escaped from his lips.
"How do you do?"
he asked again, as if I hadn't heard. The words stilted and awkward, not at home in his slack mouth.
"Very well, thank you, Mr. Kelly," I said, retrieving my hand. "It's a pleasure to meet you." Was I pushing my luck? Perhaps. But his reaction told me I had chosen precisely the right words.
"Likewise," he said,
reverting to some ancient remembered formula.
"Likewise indeed."
Was he sobering a little, or was I imagining it?
"Well then," I said, taking charge, "I can see there's no need for Miss Falthorne to be bothered. I expect she's already on her way, so I'll just run along and head her off at the pass. She'll be relieved to hear everything's under control."
"Head off at the pass" was a phrase I had heard in the cinema films, often used by Hopalong Cassidy or Randolph Scott or Roy Rogers, which seems somehow more appropriate here in North America than it did back home in Merry England, where cowboy chit-chat was as scarce as hen's dentures. I stepped to the door, Kelly tracking me with his sad eyes.
"A very great pleasure," I added.
partly for his sake, and partly for my own. My exit was as serene and duchess-like as I could manage, and it occurred to me that this leaving people standing was becoming a habit, first the Rainsmiths, and now Edward Kelly. If I kept it up, the whole planet would soon be peopled with people frozen stiff on the spot by my departures. A shout in the distance and the sound of girls laughing told me that the Academy had returned from church. The aged rector had either run out of energy or ideas, or passed away in the pulpit. I drifted toward the hockey field, wanting more than anything to be alone. It was a lovely autumn day, the sun was warm, and I still needed somewhere to think without being interrupted. I sank down onto my knees in the soft grass, planted my hands behind me, and fell back on them, turning my face upward toward the sky like a sunflower. No one would disturb me in such a posture, which clearly indicated someone communing privately with nature. I knew that hunched shoulders, hanging hair, and eyes on the ground were fairly reliable signs of a girl dejected. A girl who needed to be approached and jollied into a nice talk or a nice cup of tea, whereas a back-flung head with eyes closed and a secret smile on the upturned face was the signal of someone who needed to be left alone with her thoughts. It was clever of me to have worked out such a useful tactic. "Hello," said a voice. "May I join you?" I kept my eyes closed and my mouth shut, hoping she would go away. It was too late to form my thumbs and forefingers into little circles and begin loudly chanting, "Om Mani Padme Hum," like a Tibetan lama or the pilgrims in Lost Horizon. "Duluth," I ignored her. "Flavia, are you feeling better?" I allowed one eye to crack slightly open like an iguana. It was Jumbo. "Yes, thank you," I said, and left it at that. Most people would have felt obliged to tack on some kind of explanation, but not I. There is a mystery in silence that can never be matched by mere words. Silence is power, at least until they grab you by the neck.
"Are you sure?"
"Quite sure, thank you." I find there is always an electric thrill in such conversations, invisible fingers of excitement in the air, like lightning behind the hills.
"We were worried about you. Miss Falthorne asked me to see if you were all right."
I let my eye drift slowly shut.
"Yes, I'm quite all right, thank you."
It was incredible.
How long could I keep this up? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? An hour?
I heard the rustle of her starched skirt as Jumbo sat down beside me. Whatever was on her mind must be important enough to risk getting grass stains on her outfit. Her mouth brushed my ear as she folded herself into position beside me.
"We need to talk," she whispered.
Were we being watched? Were unknown eyes staring down at us from the tall, blank windows of Miss Bodycote's? To them, we would appear to be no more than a couple of tiny, distant sails in a vast sea of grass.
Why was I being so wary?
And why, for that matter, was Jumbo? I let my eyes come open slowly.
"I was thinking about the Michael Award," I said, which left things suitably up in the air.
"Past or present?" Jumbo was no fool. Without answering her question, I allowed myself to go all romantic.
"I couldn't help wondering what it would be like to stand up there on the stage in front of all those people, being presented with a silver archangel by... who is it that hands out those things anyway?"
"Dr. Rainsmith."
"Him or her?"
I tried to keep the excitement out of my voice. "Him, of course. She just comes along for the champagne tarts." Jumbo ought to know, I realized. At the time of Brazenose Major's disappearance, Jumbo would have been in the fifth form, and like Brazenose, she had been here for ages.
What about 2 years ago when Brazenose won it?
You need to watch your step,
Jumbo said suddenly, hissing the words.
Why?
I demanded. It's ever so easy to be bold in bright sunlight.
Things are not what they seem, she said.
I wanted to tell her that I'd been aware of that fact for as long as I could remember, but I resisted the urge.
You're wading into real danger, Jumbo continued, without even realizing it. You're already in over your head. Scarlet has tried to warn you, and so has Gremley.
I sat quietly, not wanting to break the fragile cobweb of power I had created with my semi-silence. Outwardly, I was no more than a serenely stubborn girl sitting on a sunny lawn with her nose in the air.
But what could Jumbo mean? How could I possibly be wrong in my deductions to date? I couldn't be. I was sure of it.
Until, that is, a horrific thought sprang into my mind.
What if Miss Bodycote's female academy,
besides our secret schooling in codes and ciphers and the black arts of science,
trained certain of its students in the act of murder? What if each of them, of us, was required as some kind of horrific graduation ritual to kill a human being? What if Miss Bodycote's female academy, claiming to be a girls' school so high Anglican that only a kitchen stool was required to scramble up into heaven, was, in reality, a school for assassins, an academy for murder and mayhem? Was that what Jumbo was trying to tell me?
Chapter 22. Flavia Deluce, murderer. This was not a thought that came out of nowhere. I suppose it had been simmering away in a covered pot in some subterranean kitchen of my brain for quite some time. My mind flew back several years to the night Daffy was reading The Private Hangman, a black-jacketed thriller in which Special Agent Jack Cross, alias X-9, wreaked vengeance upon the enemies of His Majesty's government by such unsubtle means as boiling their blood with high-powered radio waves, binding them eyeball to eyeball with a giant squid, extracting a confession from a traitor who was lashed to one of the screws of an about-to-be-launched destroyer whose crew he had betrayed, and, in the last few pages, removing, with the corkscrew attachment of a Boy Scout knife, a handy weapon that he was never without, the eyes of the notorious spy, Baron Noel van den Hochstein. The latter scene had brought Daffy bursting in wide-eyed terror into my bedroom and into my bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, having turned on the electric light and lit an entire box of candles, all of which she insisted be left burning until well after sunrise. At the time, I'd have hooted down anyone who suggested that I myself might one day inherit the mantle of Jack Cross X-9, the private hangman. But now I wasn't so sure. In this topsy-turvy world, anything seemed possible. And yet, until now, it had never occurred to me that I might be required to kill. My mother, of course, had been a member of the mysterious Naid, of which Aunt Felicity was chief. That much I knew, as well as the fact that there were others around me who might or might not be full-fledged agents. Gremley, for instance, who had given herself away by asking if I enjoyed my pheasant sandwiches. How I longed to quiz her, to learn more not only about her associations, but also about my own. And yet it was forbidden. it had been made quite clear to me that one must not, under any circumstances, ask questions of any girl at Miss Bodycote's about herself or about any other girl. A rule which, when you stop to think about it, made a great deal of sense. It was the only way in which those of us who were chosen for a life of service could keep our secret doings from the others. Those at the academy who were not involved, the day girls, were really no more than cover for those of us who were. They, in a way, were the drones, while we were the queens. That much I had worked out on my own. It was all part of a grand game, in which we were merely players. The rules were unwritten and needed to be deduced by each of us, an enormous maze through which each of us must make her own way, in total darkness, by trial and error. How beastly clever it all was! What if the whole thing was no more than a magnificent piece of theatre staged solely to test me? What if everyone but me had been handed their parts? But no, the drugged Collingwood was all too real. The fear I had seen in her haunted eyes was impossible to fake. "You're very quiet," Jumbo said. It was so long since either of us had spoken that I had almost forgotten she was there. I looked her straight in the eye. "I know we're not permitted to ask personal questions," I said, "but what about impersonal questions? Neither of the Rainsmiths is a student. Am I allowed to ask you about them?" That in itself was a risky question. I was keenly aware that Jumbo, as head girl, must not be compromised, that she must not be asked to break a rule. The British Empire, even in Canada, had not been built by sneaks. Like the sun after a rain, a warm smile was already stealing across Jumbo's face. "Excellent amento," she said. "Top marks. Of course you are." I felt as if I had just won the Irish sweepstakes. By her comment about the champagne tarts, I already knew that Jumbo did not care for Dorsey Rainsmith, that in terms of a sympathetic soul, I already had one foot in the door. "What have they done with Collingwood?" I asked sneakily. They, being the Rainsmiths, and therefore fair game for a question. "Took her away in an ambulance," Jumbo replied. "Before sunup. I saw it from my window." "But where?" "God only knows," Jumbo said. "All I can say is that Miss Falthorn and Fitzgibbon went with her." I felt as if I'd been punched in the solar plexus. "Miss Falthorn?" But it made sense, didn't it? I'd seen her climbing into Ryerson Rainsmith's car on the Danforth. Nothing could be clearer than the fact that they were hand in glove. "What are we going to do?" Squinting, Jumbo raised her eyes slowly to the heavens, to the fat, cumulus clouds that drifted lazily along in the painfully blue sky. "Nothing," she said. "Nothing?" My response was as quick as the return of a served tennis ball. "Nothing. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
"Meaning?"
"Whatever you take it to mean."
"How infuriating! How utterly—"
I was tempted for a moment to give her a defiant glare, but I managed, by looking away, to keep it mostly to myself. "You remind me of my sister Daffy," I said.
"Excellent," Jumbo replied,
and with that she got to her feet, brushed off her skirt, and without a backward glance strode quickly away toward the rear of the school. A kind of sadness descended upon me as I watched her walk away. A kind of sadness that was half happy and half not, which is very difficult to describe. I suppose I'd had great hopes that we would, against all odds, become great chums, and that the secrets of the universe and of Miss Bodycote's female academy would be unrolled like some great map at no cost for my inspection. But it was not to be. I was me, she was she, and the world was the world, as I had rather sourly suspected all along. I thought of the words Daffy had once recited in the drawing-room as a gift for Father's birthday. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. I could not entirely agree with dear, dead old John Donne. I had never felt more like an island in my life. I was the clod washed away by the sea. I got up from the grass, my lip trembling, and began to walk anywhere away from the school. Quite frankly, I was sick and tired of being held hostage by my emotions. I needed to take a stand with my feet rooted firmly in science, rather than in the dribblings of some lurking, self-important gland. At bottom, when you got right down to it, it was all chemistry, and chemistry should be miraculous, not miserable. I needed to rededicate myself, to follow my brain instead of my tear ducts, and to stick to cold logic no matter what. Cormel or hard water, as Mrs. Mullet had once said. I couldn't help smiling at the thought, and a minute or so later, everything was more or less tickety-boo. It was a kind of magic I didn't yet fully understand. By this time, I had reached the far boundary of the hockey field, which was marked, for the most part, by the walls and fences of adjoining properties. In the middle of a tall hedge, a small wicket gate led to parts unknown. I opened it and squeezed myself through, onto a narrow path which passed between two tall, ragged and mouldy cedar hedges. I turned my body and edged along sideways in crab fashion to avoid being brushed by the dank, unpleasant foliage, which drooped like the ostrich feather wands of the mutes at a Victorian funeral. It smelled like a place in which cats congregated. At its far end, the path opened out into a paved and boarded area, which must, at least in winter, have been flooded and used as an outdoor skating rink. It might once have been a row of tennis courts, but their tarmac was now a cracked wilderness, pierced with tufts of wild grass and weeds.
Watch yourself!
A metallic roaring behind me caused me to flinch, to leap aside, in fact, just as a compact cannonball appeared. A uniformed figure on roller skates, its eyes hidden behind ancient black sun goggles, and a yo-yo shooting wildly out on a string from one hand. Nevertheless, I recognized her at once. It was Gremley.
Sorry,
she shouted, barely missing me as she shot past and rocketed into a sharp right-hand turn, her legs crossing over like scissors, as if she had been born on skates.
Wait!
I shouted, but she didn't hear me. She roared away, down the length of the old rink, skates and yo-yo flying, across the width, along the far side, and into the final turn before passing me again.
220 yards!
She shouted as she blazed past, without giving me a chance to say a word. Round she went again, clockwise, a wound-up ball of pure energy completely compressed within her stunted frame. I waited for the next approach.
Mrs. Rainsmith,
I called out, trying to put the question mark into my voice as she flew past. Down the long side she raced, across the back stretch, and here she came again.
Bad medicine,
she shouted back from inside a whirlwind of noise. On the following lap, I kept quiet and left it to her.
Pity! First one was nicer!
And she was gone again.
First what?
I called out into the ferocious roar of racing skates. I had to wait another complete round for her reply.
First wife, Francesca, vanished.
Vanished? Like Brazenose? Like Le Marchand? Like Wentworth? It seemed scarcely credible. Was Miss Bodycote's female academy the last stop on the road to oblivion? I held up my arm, bent at the elbow, as a signal to stop, but Gremley ignored it.
Can't!
She panted as she came round again.
100 penalty laps before lunch.
Again I waited patiently until she came round once more.
Belching during the sermon,
she bellowed as she skated by, her words followed by a whinnying hoarse laugh that trailed behind her in the air like a long flapping scarf. The sheer defiance of it! And it was that, I think, more than anything, which made me decide on the spot to confront Miss Fawthorne. After all, what could they do to me? Miss Bodycote's female academy was, on a Sunday afternoon, like one of those vast Victorian boneyards, such as Highgate Cemetery in London, minus, of course, the tombstones. An unnatural hush hung over the place like a black pall, as if the slightest sound would be a mortal sin. Even the walls and floors appeared forbidding, as if they, too, wanted to be left alone, as if I were an intruder. I walked slowly along the old girl's gallery, giving no more than a glance to most of the black-edged portraits from the corner of my eye. A more frank stare seemed sacrilege. But here was Harriet in her funereal frame. I stopped for a moment, then slowly touched my fingers to my lips and transferred them to hers. Was she pleased? I couldn't tell. That was the trouble with being the daughter of a dead woman. I tore my eyes away and moved on. A little farther along, toward the end of the gallery, and I hadn't noticed this before, was Brazenose Major, Clarissa. I knew this only because her name was engraved, as were all the others, on a small silver plate at the bottom of the frame. She bore only a passing resemblance to her younger sister. You might have missed it if you weren't looking for it. I sucked in my breath. Clarissa was wearing the Michael Award round her neck, that same silver archangel with its upraised wings, which was snuggled at this very moment in my pocket. I pulled it out and compared it with the photograph. There could be no doubt about it. In spite of the tarnishing, I could easily see that they had once been identical. A chill worked its way up my spine and down again. The photograph must have been taken the night of her disappearance. The night, perhaps, of her death. She had vanished after the ball. My footsteps slowed as I came closer to Miss Fawthorne's study. Last chance to back out, I thought. Last chance to let sleeping dogs lie. There are choices in life which you are aware, even as you make them, cannot be undone. Choices after which, once made, things will never be the same. There is that moment when you can still walk away, but if you do, you will never know what might have been. St. Paul on the road to Damascus might have pleaded sunstroke, for example, and the world would have been a different place.